Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 72. My name is Karen, and I'm joined by Kristen.
Hello, everyone.
I have a question for you, Kristen.
Oh, boy.
I came prepared.
Oh, boy.
I have a question of the day.
Oh, boy. This does not bode well for me.
Actually, it's totally fine. It's just something that I saw online that is very much like our vibe, so I wanted to present it to you. Hiccup and Astrid are just Percy and Annabeth, but in a different font. Right? You should see the journey her face just went on.
That is not incorrect.
Right? I was actually like, wait a second, okay.
That is not incorrect.
Yeah.
He gives very strong Percy vibes.
She gives very strong Annabeth vibes.
Yeah.
I'm definitely into it.
Yeah. They're just a pointier font.
Yeah. Yes. I understand that a little bit.
Yeah.
They're like bold type, too.
Right.
I feel like.
With like old-fashioned
embellishments,
pointy embellishments. Yes, yeah. Just because things have to be sharper when you're fighting with dragons.
Yes,
you know?
And bulkier.
Right.
Yeah,
that's hilarious.
I know.
It's very true.
Yeah. Also, this has nothing to do with Percy Jackson at all. Did you see they're making a live-action How to Train Your Dragon?
I saw something about this the other day. I think I just scrolled right past it. Like this can't happen. This is not going to happen.
Look. I love How to Train Your Dragon. I think it's one of the best, the first one especially, one of my top favorite movies of all time. I love the trilogy as a whole. And, like, I love live-action remakes. That's the weird part. I do, but you don't need it with this. Like, yeah. I don't feel the call to it. But anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I don't know. I just don't think you're gonna... Jay Baruchel is too old to actually cast as Hiccup, and I cannot imagine anybody doing Hiccup better than him.
Yeah.
Which I think is the problem.
Jay Baruchel is mannerisms, too.
Yeah, like, he's a caricature of a person.
Yeah.
Just being himself.
Yeah.
And so, like, I have a hard time, seeing some 15-year-old taking on that much crazy. Honest to God, if he wasn't already Percy, I'd say Walker could probably do it.
I mean, that's probably
but, like,
fair.
And I don't think he will, because he's Percy. But, yeah. Like, if he wasn't, he would be someone I would say, that kid's got the snark and the wit to kind of handle it. So, I don't know.
That's In 5 years, we might be eating our words, but
right?
Until then, I am not into it.
I'm cautiously cautiomistic. It's not optimistic. It's not pessimistic. I am cautiously cautious about this.
Cautiomistic. I love that. We're patenting that. That is so perfect. I love it so much. If you would like to contact us to tell us how you feel about How to Train Your Dragon, about Hiccup and Astrid basically being like Percy and Annabeth,
about cautiomistic.
Yeah, if you want to talk to us about made-up words, please do so. All words are made up. you can do
and
that.
And the points don't matter. Okay.
Wrong show. Contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. If you just have too many words to be contained on social media, write us an essay. We'll read it.
We promise.
Thank you. Okay, news and updates. There is not a whole lot of news right now. However, I will say we are, with bated breath, waiting for this announcement that Becky has promised us in a couple of hours. And I tweeted at her and I was like, hopefully we get this news by the time we start recording, or finish recording, really.
Yeah.
And it hasn't come out yet, so we're going to check the news again at the end.
We do know that it's publishing news.
Yes.
Not TV news. It's book news.
So okay, so let's speculate.
I know. I was like, we can get the live speculation going right now.
Could be a new Rick Riordan book/author.
Yes.
Could be a cover for Chalice of the Gods. We don't have that yet.
Guess what?
Did it come out?
Yes.
Is it a cover?
Yes.
Okay.
It's for Chalice of the Gods.
Live
It's
updates.
Entertainment Weekly. It literally, I refreshed Twitter and it popped up.
Oh my gosh. live updates here on Prophecy Radio. You just have to wait 3 days to
listen to
us.
We're living life live here. You just have to wait 3 days to find out what we were doing when it happened. Yeah. It's in the new style. Yeah.
Oh, so this is Victo Nye?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's pretty.
That's my guess because this is the same style as the others.
Yeah.
It's very pretty.
All right, let's check this out. So, yeah, it's on EW. We'll definitely link to it, although I'm sure you'll have seen it by then.
Yes.
Fans of Percy Jackson have a lot to look forward to in the near future. TV adaptation, new books as well, The Sun and the Star. Ryden will be checking back in with his original protagonist in Chalice of the Gods, also due this year. And EW caught up with him to reveal the cover. Ooh, and a conversation. So, let's see. How do we want to do this? I haven't read this, so I can't summarize. So let's just, you know, I'll read the question, you read his answer. Does that sound good?
Sure.
Okay. So Entertainment Weekly says, obviously you've been working on the new Percy Jackson show at Disney for a little while, and I assume a lot of that has been reconnecting with the beginnings of Percy's story and figuring out how to approach the Lightning Thief in this new way. So what inspired you to tell a new Percy story at the same time that you're revisiting his beginnings?
The idea for Chalice of the Gods actually started out when we were looking at the adaptation process again, and was kind of my idea to sort of pitch something that might be of interest to Disney overall as a way of saying, well, what we could do is, if you guys are open to doing a new TV show, maybe I could revisit Percy and do a new Percy book for the first time in an umpteen number of years. Turns out I didn't need that as a pitch, but as we were going through the TV show process, I started, as you say, reconnecting with the characters and getting to know them all over again, and we started talking about what publishing could do to support the TV show. I thought back to the ideas that I had pitched for new Percy books, and that had kind of been stewing on the back burner for a while, and it just felt like the right time. It felt like the right thing to do to celebrate Percy Jackson coming home to a new adaptation. And the story was just fun. I like the idea that Percy has a day in the life adventure and it's not the world is at stake. We can all relate to that situation. Oh Lord, I have to apply to college now. It's something I've been through with my kids, and I think especially a lot of the older readers might enjoy that. So it's been a lot of fun.
Woohoo! Pumping my fist up.
Woo-hoo, the woohoo was me. That was
yeah,
me.
Yeah, Rick didn't type woohoo at
Rick the end isn't of that. Woohooing in yeah. this interview.
So, I mean, a lot of that I think is pretty much stuff that we've heard before, but still, you know, just I like that he's been very open about the fact that he was doing it to kind of help boost the TV show. Like, he's not trying to hide that or anything.
Yeah.
So next question is, so this is an idea that had occurred to you over the years, but the timing wasn't right as you were caught up in other projects?
Yeah, I mean, it just didn't seem like the timing was right until all the cogs and the wheels kind of turned the same direction. It was very interesting working on the Chalice of the Gods while also working on the Lightning Thief as a TV season, because one informed the other. When my wife Becky, who is always my first editor and my first Aww. Reader, first read parts of Chalice of the Gods for me, she said, it's amazing how much of the TV show is in this new book. Not content-wise, but in terms of voice and just little nuances that we snuck into the TV show that are informing the new book with Percy. So yeah, it's been a great amount of fun to do both at the same time.
That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting that, you know, obviously Walker's Percy is going to be different from Logan's Percy or any other Percy, but he's still getting that from the books. The books are informing him.
Yeah.
So then for Rick to kind of turn that around and use Walker's Percy as inspiration, you know, it's not like he's writing these books. I mean, maybe he wrote them kind of with Walker, Leah, and Arian in mind, but like they still have to match up with what
Yeah.
the other books did.
Yeah.
But I kind of like the idea that it's like all kind of full circle and interlaced now.
It's the, what do they call it, like an Ouroboros?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With the snake that eats its tail.
Yeah.
Rick created these books, and now he's looking at these people that he helped cast playing his characters, and they're kind of inspiring him to do more, and that's cool. Yeah, I'm a fan for sure.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned that the book will be following him in the college application process. How has Percy changed or grown since the last time we saw him on page?
Well, the poor guy is still 17. I've stuck him in time, so he can't graduate high school, at least not yet. He's starting his senior year. This is after the Heroes of Olympus and before the Trials of Apollo. So it's his fall semester, senior year, new high school again. He and Annabeth and Grover are just trying to be New York kids and enjoy being seniors, but also avoiding the monster attacks. And the idea for him is that if he can just get through high school, statistically speaking, it gets a lot better for demigods, because by then, they're a little too old and a little too powerful for monsters to be attacking every week. So they could, conceivably, have a normal adulthood, and that would be awesome. But when you're a demigod, you never take anything for granted. So he's older and wiser to a point. He has a lot of experience to draw on. He's not the new demigod on the block anymore, but he still has that same snarky sense of humor. The Percy Jackson voice was the easiest thing for me to get back into. It's just so near and dear to me. It was really lovely to be able to write from Percy's first point of view again, which I haven't done in quite a while.
I have to say that when you really, you know, listen to, especially the blog posts, I feel like the blog posts really show you how much Rick and Percy are alike, because they are both sass masters, and I love every second of it.
Yeah, you can tell that Percy, he wrote the Percy books for his son, like, that was the whole purpose, but, like, you can tell that there's a lot of Rick's character in Percy, like, just who he is and how he reacts to things. It's all in there. Yeah.
I bet. You and I talked years ago at the Magnus Chase launch event in New York, and Trials of Apollo was going on at the same time. So you've done these other books. You've lived with these other protagonists like Magnus and Apollo. What is still fun about Percy as a protagonist after spending time with these other characters?
I mean, Percy is my alter ego in a lot of ways.
There you go.
He's also my son's alter ego. So, I mean, he's really a member of my family. When I write Percy, it's just like chatting with a family member at the dinner table, and it's so familiar to me. So I'm not going to say it's easy, because I do have to work to channel his voice and be on point and make sure he's being clever enough and being Percy enough. But it is very familiar to me, and I like to compare the Percy voice to a comfortable pair of jeans. I mean, you put them on and it's like you're at home. It's the easiest thing.
That. Especially because Percy just lost his pants in a story
not too long ago. We just read about Percy losing his pants.
What can you tease about how college works for demigods? How did you build that out in this world?
In previous books, I've kind of hinted that the plan, as Annabeth sees it, is that she and Percy will go to the demigod college at University of New Rome in the Bay Area in California. But at the same time, they will also be sort of dual enrolling in a local mortal college. So Annabeth is thinking UC Berkeley. I don't know if Percy can get in there with his grades, but that's the idea. That they will go to college together, hopefully, and be safe in the Bay Area, have a nice experience there, and then after that, who knows? She wants to study architecture and design. Percy just wants to pass.
That's pretty cute, and I didn't think about them possibly being in two different schools at the same time. Like, demigod school for the things that they'll need to know to be adult demigods, but then also, like, mortal school where they study architecture and that sort of thing.
When I thought New Rome University, I was like, oh, it's like a university.
Right.
But like, obviously it's not like an accredited mortal university.
So they would still need, if they want a real job in the mortal world, then they would need
some sort of school or something. Or a vocation or whatever, but
that begs a lot of questions about how adult demigods, like, make money and exist in the mortal world, because they still, you know, like you said, they're old enough now that they don't get attacked all the time, but, like, it's still a possibility, and if the world is in danger, then they'll have to come together for that sort of thing, so...
Yeah.
Now I want an adult Percy Jackson series, because that would be amazing.
Paying taxes!
Yeah. Yeah! Oh, gosh.
Paying taxes, getting day-to-day whatever, paying health care bills, and then also fighting the Sphinx.
Never mind, that's depressing. I don't want an adult series. I have to deal with that on my own.
No, it could be cute, though, if he ever wanted to write something with him a little older later. It could be cute.
The previous five Percy Jackson books touched on a lot of the greatest hits of Greek mythology, I guess you could call them. What Greek myths or characters were left over that you're now getting the chance to explore?
The amazing thing is, even after writing about Greek and Roman mythology for 15 books, there are still characters, monsters, and gods that I haven't even touched. The obvious one is Ganymede, who is the center of this story. He's lost his cup, and he's the cupbearer of the gods.
That doesn't sound good.
Especially since the cup, if you drink from it and you're immortal, it can make you immortal. So it's not one of those things you want floating around in the world. You kind of want to know where it is. So I had to dig into Ganymede's past and think about, okay, well, if he's lost his cup, why would that be? Turns out there are a lot of people who have it in for Ganymede in Greek mythology, a lot of other gods who don't like him very much for various reasons. So it gave me a chance to get into some internal family politics among the Olympians that I haven't really explored. That's what it really is. It's about bickering among the family. It's not so much about the scary monsters. Sure, there are scary monsters too, but it's mostly about the bickering between the gods and how they always get in trouble. And then, of course, they always need demigods to get them out of it.
Yeah, Hera's not his biggest fan, if I recall correctly.
That is true. Annabeth and Percy, having had their fill of Hera, are hoping that she's not behind this. They don't think so because it's a little bit beneath her, but maybe. But there are a whole lot of other culprits to figure out. It's a whodunit, really. Who stole the cup?
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I find that really cool. I mean, and especially this dynamic between the gods, that's always fascinating to me.
Well, that kind of harkens back to Lightning Thief, too. Like, who stole the Master Bolt. So, yeah. I can see how, if this is really just about digging into something has happened, the gods, something's missing, the gods need it back, he's a demigod, he's who they choose. Mm-hmm. Like, I can see how that would reflect a lot of Lightning Thief.
It's funny you say that, because the next line is, that has some resonances with the Lightning Thief, right? Because a whodunit is how this all started.
I totally did not read ahead.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, I did not. Absolutely, and Percy remarks on that in Chalice of the Gods. It's like, what is it with these gods? They need tracking devices on their armies.
Since we're doing the cover reveal for the book, I wanted to ask you a bit about this image of the chalice with these creatures coming out of it. They look like birds, and then maybe a snake or a hydra. What can you tell us about these images?
A lot of those are sacred animals to various gods, so there's a hint for you. They are symbols of the gods, but they're also creatures that Percy and Annabeth and Grover will actually have to face in one way or another. I love Vic Donai's art because it's stylized, and it's very symbolic without being over-representational. I like that style because it reminds me of the retro 60s and 70s sci-fi and fantasy novels that I grew up on. The old Lord of the Rings covers sort of had that vibe to them, and I really respond to that. I think covers like that tend to engage your imagination and let you fill in the blanks, like you were just doing. Okay, there's a bird. What does that mean? That's what we want you to think. We want you to use your imagination and try to decode the mystery of all the symbols on the cover without it just being, boom, here's a kid with a sword fighting a big flaming thing.
That's really interesting. I'm scrolling back up to the cover. So we do have a large snake-like creature with, horns?
Yeah.
Or something?
They look to be horns.
Yeah, and then two birds. They kind of look like chickens?
Possibly?
Like roosters, almost.
Oh, yeah, they do. They both look like roosters, yeah. They've got the little whatchamacallit thingy.
The little gobble
and the gobble thingy. Yeah. And then the actual, cup itself has a that's a satyr, and a demigod who looks to be wearing a camp t-shirt. That definitely looks like a t-shirt, not just it's an old-timey shirt. It's got, bands on it.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's a girl.
I wonder if that's Percy and Annabeth. That's Riptide and that's her dagger.
Yeah. I was gonna say, my guess is that it's Percy and Annabeth.
And that's Grover.
Oh, duh.
Because his horns are big.
They are really big.
Wow. Okay.
And then there's, some pretty lightning bolts on the bottom that are sticking out to my brain.
That amphora type thing, I don't think that's the right word for it. It looks like Hercules, Disney's Hercules. Yeah. It reminds me of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I like a lot.
There's a lot of little details, but I don't think there's, tons and tons of things that are going to give away the story. But yeah, like Rick said, you can kind of see, the snake and the chickens and the whatever. It makes you kind of wonder, where is this going?
Yeah.
Whose sacred animal is the chicken?
That's what I was looking up. Specifically rooster, because it does have to do with Asclepius. Is that how you pronounce his name? The healing god?
Maybe Asclepius? I think I've heard it said both ways.
Yeah. And Minerva and Mars. So I don't know if that's, technically the Roman version of that.
Okay.
But we'll have to see. And then that snake with, horns. Ooh, okay. So the Kerastes is a creature described in Greek mythology as a snake with either two large ram-like horns or four pairs of smaller horns.
Okay. I wouldn't necessarily describe these as ram-like, but they are definitely horns. So this may just be the artistic representation of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like I have more questions than answers now, but...
That sounds about right.
Yeah, but that's pretty cool.
This may just be artistic embellishment again, but it also looks like it's, like, steaming.
Yeah, well, there's even flames in the background, too.
Yeah, yeah. So,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the next question is, going back to Ganymede and his cup, you mentioned that it has these properties where mortals can drink it and become immortal. That can't help but remind me of not just the Holy Grail, but the antecedents of the Holy Grail in Celtic mythology, all the magic cauldrons. You've become something of an expert in comparative mythology over the years. As you were doing these deep dives on Ganymede, that must have struck you, the resemblance to some other mythologies.
Yeah, the chalice is such an omnipresent image in world mythology. It is so symbolic of so many things. It's both nourishment and life, but it's also poison and betrayal. It's power, but it's also warmth and family. It can mean so many things. And the missing cup, of course, as we know from the Holy Grail and everything else, that's one of the classic motifs of folklore and mythology. So it was fun to play with that. It was especially fun because it made so much sense to me that if you have a cup that turns people immortal, the only demigod Ganymede would trust to look for something like that would be Percy, because he's literally the only living demigod who's ever turned down immortality.
I love that.
Yeah, that makes so it makes a lot of logical sense.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Percy's already had his shot at it. He's not interested.
Yeah.
So he's the least threatening to Ganymede. So of course he would reach out and say something. Makes logical sense.
So do you think of Chalice of the Gods as Percy Jackson the Olympian's book number 6, or is it, like you say, more of just a day-in-the-life adventure?
I mean, I wanted it to read like Percy Jackson 6, in the sense that if you were to pick this up right after The Last Olympian, the tone would be very familiar. The characters would be familiar. The action would feel like a classic Percy Jackson book. Now, in terms of plot, it doesn't continue the story chronologically. It doesn't relate directly to those events. This is, after all, a year or 2 years later, so it's more like a coda to the Percy Jackson series. And there are little references to things that happen in Heroes of Olympus, but I tried to be very conscious of the fact that you can read this book without necessarily having to know what happened in all 15 books previously.
Okay, that's interesting. It doesn't sound like you're tired of Percy or anything. Could you possibly come back for more in the future?
I mean, I had a good long break from writing the classic Percy novels. It's been well over a decade since I wrote in that voice, and I think that break was nice. I do think that going back to it now with the TV series made sense. It's sort of my version of a thank you letter to all the fans who have stuck with me over the years and have been waiting for the TV show. It's my way of celebrating with them. It's like a high school reunion. Let's go back and see our old friends again and get back in that vibe that we had in the original series to celebrate the Lightning Thief being reborn.
That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I got into Percy young, I think before the Titan's Curse. That was the first new one for me when I was reading them. Now as a journalist and writer who covers this work, I can't help but notice how much the fan base has grown over the years, how intensely loyal they are, how interested they are in any new snippet about your work or Percy. It looks like they're going to have a really great couple years ahead.
I certainly hope so. We're excited, and it's neat to see this multi-generational fandom get invested in the books and in the TV show as well. I mean, we would never have believed back in 2005 that Percy Jackson would still be a thing in 2023. I mean, that's a good run, and every day just feels like gravy. It's like, I can't believe I'm still doing this, and they pay me money to write these stories. I feel very grateful.
I love that. I mean, just being an older fan and stuff and loving that it's still relevant, being able to do the podcast, like, I feel, you know, it's probably not quite what it was back in the heyday when, like, the books were actively coming out, but the fandom's still very strong, and with the TV show coming out, I could easily see it kind of eclipsing.
And that. I mean, I read the books later. Like, I read them when I was already in my 20s. So, like, I am not the generation that grew up with Percy. Like, I'm of that generation, but I am not one of them. I kind of came into it later. But there are a lot of kids who read those books when they came out, and they are now 30 years old with kids, and they're giving those books to their children to read, and their kids are fans, and their kids are the ones who are going to be watching Percy Jackson with them on Disney Plus, and they're both going to be freaking out. So, like, it literally is, like, the generational thing. Like, and not all books last that long. Like, some do, some, you know, stand the test, but, like, not all of them do. And so it's kind of extra special that this book has been relevant this long and still continues to be.
Yeah, definitely. We've been talking so much about Percy as a character, his viewpoint and his perspective. What are you excited for people to see about Walker Scobell's portrayal of him in the upcoming series?
Oh my gosh. Walker's Percy is just totally spot on. I mean, it's really hard to take a book that is told 100% from a first-person narrator and translate it to film, because you can't. I mean, I guess you could have a voiceover narrative.
Yeah, but it's not the same.
It's not the same. So we have to figure out how to convey Percy's personality in other ways. Through his lines of dialogue, through his expressions, through his actions. And Walker has that sense of alchemy. Everybody says this about him when they watch him perform. This kid is a superstar. The screen loves him, and he is so good and so natural and so dedicated at everything. It really is stunning, and he's a huge mega fan of the books. I kid you not, he's read the books more times than I have. So he's pre-reading The Sun and the Star right now. He could not wait. I was like, okay, I'll get you an advance copy, but you've got to keep it to yourself. But that love of the series and the source material really comes through.
Ah! If I didn't already love Walker enough, oh my gosh.
I love that Walker's like, give me a copy. Give me a copy right now.
That's so true about him being a superstar, though, because when we watched The Adam Project, like, it was so, like, I've seen a lot of kid actors before in various things, and, like, you can kind of tell when they're, like, you know, they're good at what they do because they're kids, and, like, they usually have very good imaginations or whatever, but then to find a kid who just, like, elevates that role and, like, can go toe-to-toe with somebody who's been on screen for decades already, like, you don't find that in every kid, and Walker is just so good. I'm so excited to see where his career goes from here.
I definitely second that. Like, there's, when you think back to, like, children stars in shows that you watched as a kid or movies you watched as a kid, there are very few that are able to continue a career past that. Like, for every Drew Barrymore or, I can't even think of a second one, maybe like Zac Efron, who's managed to kind of make that crossover, you also have tons of people, you also have tons of people like the Olsen twins who cannot get past having to do all of that as a child, and just, it just jades you to the entire industry and you get out of it. Or like the kid from The Christmas Story who like was in those movies or did that movie and then was like out, like just didn't do anything else. And there's plenty of stories like that. Recently, people have kind of come out of the woodwork from, like, Boy Meets World. Like, some of the side characters, like the bullies, we kind of learned, like, oh my god, that's Adam Scott. But, like, you see some of the other characters.
I did not know that.
One of the bullies from Boy Meets World is Adam Scott, who
that's
is now.
So funny. Yeah.
But, like, you see some of these other guys, and you're like, oh, like, they did kind of drop off the face of the world. Like, you know, I never saw him in anything else after this, because it's so hard. But Walker has that thing.
He has staying power.
Yeah, like, he's got, as a kid, he relates really well to his adult co-stars. Like, you can tell that when he's on set with Ryan Reynolds, he's throwing, you know, him and Ryan are, like, working together. It's not just Ryan's working with a kid, and he's, you know, doing his best not to be inappropriate. I don't know. Be Ryan Reynolds. You know what I mean? Like, he's working with a kid. No, they're co-stars. They're working together. They're getting the scene done.
Yeah.
You can tell Walker has enough maturity to kind of, like, participate, not just, like, be a kid star. So, yeah, I really see a very bright future for him, especially he's taking on Percy, who's, you know, he's playing his age. He's playing 12, 13, you know, years old. And is going to have, hopefully, a little time to grow with this character, kind of through those awkward teen years. And then that will be a launching point for whatever he wants to do after this. So, I there's a very bright future for that kid.
It'd be very cool. So, does this also give us a hint that there won't be voiceover? Because people have been speculating about that.
I would imagine there's probably some areas where they couldn't get past that. Like, maybe some... I don't think the entire series is going to be a voiceover series. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine.
I wonder if
think.
Even just the opening the opening part of the book will be, and then there won't be any after that.
Right. Like, hi, this is... I'm Percy Jackson, and here's where I am now. And then you, like, get to where he currently is in their story, and boom, you never get voiceover again. I could also see it being kind of like, and this is a lame example, like a Grey's Anatomy kind of thing, where Meredith occasionally does, like, voiceover over the episode. Like, it's more, like, reflective at that point. She's talking about bigger themes of the episode. But, like, occasionally they'll use that, and it doesn't feel weird. It just kind of works because you need something kind of talking over the visuals you're seeing or whatever.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine there may be an opportunity or two where they need voiceover, where Percy's underwater and he literally can't speak. So yeah. You're getting some of the stuff that's going on in his head at that moment. But it sounds like they've done a good job of really trying to bring that out and put it into the dialogue, into the action, and not rely on voiceover.
Yeah. And when you have somebody like Walker, I feel like it's not going to be hard for him to get across Percy's emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would think we're probably not going to get a ton of voiceover, which part of me is like, oh, it's just such a good way to, like, bring Percy to life. But I also think I would rather see him do that emotionally, like, through his eyes and his acting and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So
basically, I trust them.
Yeah, I trust them.
I'm trusting
too.
Them to make the right decisions.
Yeah. Well, that was unexpected. So this episode this week was going to be short and easy, and it turned out not to be, because we've already been talking about this interview and this cover for half an hour, but that's okay. I do want to give you the last couple of bits of news. Basically, Reed Riordan put out an article to celebrate Black heroes with these fan favorite titles from Rick Riordan Presents, and we got Tristan Strong in there by Kwame Mbalia, and we got Sarwa Boateng by Roseanne A. Brown, which we found out is going to be a trilogy.
Woo-hoo.
A little secret announcement that it's a trilogy. So we will get Witchcraft and Mayhem this year in September. And then we'll also be getting another book after that to finish out the trilogy. So congrats,
nice.
Roseanne.
Yeah.
We are very happy for you.
I mean, we are big fans, so, you know.
Yes, huge fans. Okay, let's get into our main discussion for today, which is about Winston Chu versus the Whimsies by Stacy Lee. This book came out on February 7th, so you've all had a couple of weeks to read it. I hope you did, because it was a good story. It's kind of chaotic, but, like, in a good way, like... And I think the more that Stacy talks about Winston and how he's, like, based on her son and what she kind of pulled from her son's personality, like, the chaos in this book just makes so much sense.
Yeah, the last week when we met to record, the one thing you had kind of mentioned about this book that for you, like, it was a little chaotic. That was the word, and I think it is the word for
yeah.
this book. When I start a book, especially, like, something that's skewed a little younger, I don't really necessarily think a lot about, okay, I'm starting a new book, blah, blah, blah. It's just kind of like, all right, let's just get into it. And so I didn't really get that into play, like, the chaos of it. But, oh my goodness, I had so much trouble following the first couple of chapters.
Really?
Just because there were so many characters and so many names
yeah.
and things going on, and then he was here, and then he's here, and then this is going on, and then this, and then he's in a shop, and then this is being thrown at him, and this is falling, and I'm like, what just happened?
Yeah, you're thrown into a whirlwind.
Who is in his family? Who is his mother? What is happening? Yeah, so I think once this book gets to about chapter, like, 8 to 10, things start to just calm down.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a really strong through line for the rest
yeah.
of the book. So if you have a little trouble getting into this, I think it's just kind of getting a piece of Winston. Like, I don't think
I think it's purposeful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Me
yeah.
too. I don't think it's, like, a mistake. I don't think it's, you know, bad writing or anything dumb like that. I think it's literally getting into Winston's head.
Yeah.
Because everything is chaos in Winston's head all
yeah.
the time. He kind of talks to himself at one point, and this is one of my favorite parts of the book, where he's in school and he's like, telling a story, and he's like, no, stop it. No, I can't. Ah! And words are coming out of his head before he can even stop himself
from telling the
story.
Yes.
Like, that was a perfect illustration of the beginning of this book, because it was like, I didn't know exactly what was happening every second of the beginning, but by the end, I got everything. Like, yeah. I understood all the characters, I got a good sense of who was who, like, but at the beginning, people were talking, and I'm like, who? Which character said that? Who is that? That's his friend, but which friend is that? Is that, wait, is that the guy friend or the girl? I don't know. So yeah, I got a little lost in the beginning. But again, I think it's kind of purposeful, and it was a good read generally, though.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, I didn't actually write this down in terms of what we were going to talk about, but in my review that I did for Subjectify, which I'll link to, I talked about the fact that she is so good at getting across the voice of a 12-year-old boy.
100%.
Like, the way that they talk about their video games, the way that they make up words and have all these, like, little things that they do, and, like, just the, like, chaos and stuff that they're all kind of always wrapped up in. And soccer, the way that they're just obsessed with soccer and think about soccer all the time. I'm like, obviously, like, we know now that she pulled a lot of this from her son, and it makes so much sense why it was so good, because I was like, wow, you know, like, this, I don't know what it's like to be a 12-year-old boy, and, you know, she's obviously a woman and didn't, you know, probably grow up the same way that her son did, but she captured that voice so perfectly that I was like, really impressed by it.
Honestly, yeah. Like, it's very easy to kind of see things from Winston's perspective. And as the book goes on, you do kind of start to think of things the way he would a little bit. It's very well written. I think very well done. And yeah, definitely a fan.
Did you listen to the audiobook?
I did.
How was that?
Chaotic. Especially at the beginning. Usually that's the hardest part for me, especially when I'm listening to an audiobook, like, well, I usually listen while I work because I have a job that allows me to do that, which is great. And so it's hard sometimes to focus on what I'm listening to as well as focusing on my work that I'm doing. But once I get into a sweet spot where I kind of recognize different characters in the book, it becomes second nature. It's really easy and whatever. So it's starting the new book sometimes can be a little difficult. And I did have a little trouble yesterday kind of getting into it. But once I got to about chapter 8 or 10, that was where it just cruised. And for the rest of the time, I just really, really enjoyed the story. Mm-hmm. The beginning of the book with him actually, like, meeting Mr. Peng and, like, all of that, I think that's kind of one of the scenes that I'm least clear about, because, like, I remember the general happenings, but some of the details of that scene, it's something I would like to return to at some point and see if I can pick up on all of the details now that I have a better idea who Cassa is and who Winston really is and all, you know, like, all of them. I have a better picture of, like, who is who and what's going on.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, too, Brian Kim McCormick is the one who does the narration for Winston Chu, but you liked his narration?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did a very good job kind of giving them all voices. I particularly, for some reason, and I don't know why, loved how he did Cassa.
Really?
She's just so, I mean, we're going to probably talk about this in a minute, but, like, her character is so, like, specific. Like, I can tell you who Cassa is, like, from pretty soon into the book till the end. Like, I knew how she was going to react to things, and I love that character so much. His voice for Cassa was so different from most other, like, young girl characters when a guy is doing a young girl character's voice. Like, they kind of affect it a little just so you can tell it's a different character speaking, and I loved what he did for Cassa. It was very fun.
That's great. So, I mean, if you haven't guessed already, and if you're listening to this not having read the book, the general plot of Winston Chu versus the Whimsies is that Winston saves Mr. Peng's shop from getting robbed, and so he's offered the first thing that he lays his hands on inside this shop of Whimsies, and he accidentally picks up an old broom and dustpan and is forced to take it home. That's, like, the opening chapter, I think. It's right in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then various things start disappearing, and then Winston's world gets flipped on its head when the next thing that goes missing is his baby sister. And we will be talking about
that. I was going to say, but also kind of not really, which is also weird.
Yes, yeah. So we've already talked about him quite a lot, but Winston Chu, let's just start with him. He's kind of a chaotic kid who's always moving. He's always kind of acting before he thinks. I like that at one point in the story, this becomes an asset, not a detriment. Like, it's a good thing that he acts before he thinks because he does what he needs to do and kind of saves the day because of it.
Yeah. Other people see it as a flaw. Like, I think his sister points it out to him at one point. Like, you don't look before you leap. You run into things. And he's like, yeah, but sometimes that's how the job gets done. Like, sometimes you need to do that. And I like that he kind of accepts that about himself at one point. Like, rather than always trying to change, he's like, sometimes maybe it's just how you need it to be.
Yeah.
I think he relates it to soccer. Like, if you think twice, like, if you overthink things, you're not going to get this goal scored.
Right.
And I think that's kind of very relatable for a young boy.
Yeah, yeah. I also really liked that he wasn't the team captain. I think a lot of times in these stories, like, the kid, you know, is usually, like, in a leadership role in some sense or another. And, like, it was his friend who was the team captain, not him. But he loves soccer. He's very good at it. And, you know, his teammates are pretty good at it. And they all kind of, they have their own formations, and it informs a lot of, like, how they go through the world as well, which was cute.
It kind of, like, if you think about how we kind of have accepted that there are different types of people who play, like, different Quidditch positions.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he's a seeker. Like, that's become, like, a running joke, kind of, in the Harry Potter fandom or whatever. It's kind of very similar to how they structure it here with, like,
yeah.
Oh, well, this is, like, this kid's a defender, and then you find out that in his life, he is very defensive. Like, he tries to help people and is always looking out for people and that sort of thing. So, like, yeah, I like that relation, like, that sport does can kind of bring that out of you. Like,
yeah.
The positions that you find most appealing can kind of relate to who you are.
It's so funny you say that because I've been watching a lot of basketball documentaries lately, and I am seeing, like, a lot. I watched the Redeem Team, and I also watched The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan one. And it wasn't just Michael Jordan, but it was kind of Michael Jordan. And, you could see there are some correlations to the way people play sports and then how they act in real life. So, yeah, you're right. It's really cool.
Point guards are very different people from power forwards. It's just, they're very different people. Okay, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah. The other thing about Winston is that his dad died in Iraq, and he now lives with his mother and two sisters, Philippa and Coco. And I want to return to this later because there's a bit of a spoiler thing that we'll get into with that, but I think we both have a lot to say about this plot point.
Yes.
But for now, we also have his best friends and San Francisco stealth soccer teammates. We have Mav, who is his best friend and the captain, and Monroe's little brother. Get to Monroe in a second. There's Casa, who's the best striker. There's Bijal, who is the best defender. And, I mean, I guess I kind of already know this. Do any of them stick out to you?
Honestly, they each kind of stick out to me in some way or another. I think Bijal is the one I'm least, like, drawn to. I love Casa so much.
Yeah.
She's just a very particular character, and I feel like we don't get a lot of female characters like her, where she's really good at deception, she's really good at, like, talking her way out of things and getting parents to do what she wants, and, like, she's a very charismatic, interesting person.
Yeah.
I really love Casa. I loved every time Casa came into a scene or, like, was, you know, it was kind of hanging back and then steps forward in a scene, I was like, oh boy. Where, like, this is going to be good. Like, this is going to be a good moment.
She has a very strong personality, and one that she's not apologetic for, and the boys accept her as she is. There's really no, like, oh, you're a girl, you can't do this, or something. Like, they trust her like they trust each other, and there's really no, like,
they depend on her a lot.
Yeah.
She gets them out of a lot of scrapes in this book, and it's nice that they do, like, just trust her that much.
Yeah.
And, I mean, she's a striker, I'm pretty sure, I'm not a soccer fiend or anything. Pretty sure a striker's a scorer. They're the person that, like, sticks their neck out and, you know, they take off, you know, looking for a pass to score and all of that sort of thing. So, like, yeah, it fits that she's kind of the one who's not afraid to take on a challenge when everyone else is a little unsure. She'll kind of stick herself out there and be like, all right, I've got this. Like, I'll do it. I have to say, I also do have a little bit of a sore spot for Mav, who just is so, like, I kind of liked that Mav was a little bit, like, more soft-spoken than Winston or Casa. Like, I like that despite being kind of rich, his dad is really well off. Winston is not really, he doesn't have to be the center of attention, which is kind of a trope that we've gotten into in books. Like, if a character is well off, like, they usually want to be the center of attention all the time. You can tell Mav is not all about that life. Like, he has his friends, he likes his friends, you know, he buys Winston a little trinket. We find out near the beginning of the book that he bought him a little Hulkbuster thing, but, like, he doesn't throw hit flaunt his money. It's not important to him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, I really did have a soft spot for Mav too. I like how he's kind of okay with being soft spoken and kind of the quiet one, unless he needs to be heard. And then right. he kind of can make himself heard.
Yeah. I really liked Mav too. I think that he's very aware of his family's wealth, and, you know, him and Winston butt heads at one point over this, and Mav is like, okay, I understand that I come from a wealthy family and that I'm better off and that I have some privilege because of this, but, like, my home life isn't perfect either. And it's interesting to see Winston kind of take that in and be like, okay, like, just because he's, you know, got a better life than me in one aspect doesn't mean his life's perfect. Right. And Winston, I feel like, has a little bit of insecurity about Mav's wealth, whereas I think Mav doesn't think about it that way with his friends. Like, he's just friends with his friends. Like, you know, and
they like soccer, they like their video game. That's, like, his money has nothing to do with that.
Right.
Yeah.
But I really liked Casa too. I liked that we got some home life stuff with Casa and her dad's girlfriend. I thought that was really interesting. And the truth serum kind of scene was, like, really funny and good and a little emotional, too. So that was really cool.
Very serious. I think Bijal, I think one of the reasons why that character didn't particularly stick out to me or was not one that I gravitated toward is because I am very different from Bijal. Like, Bijal hides his true self from his family. And from, like, most, you know, like, his friends get to know his true self, but, like, the majority of the world only sees what Bijal wants them to see. I think I have trouble doing that. Like, I have trouble, you know, kind of, what is it, like, segmenting my personality. Like, sometimes it's natural and it works out that way, but, like, I think I have trouble with that. Not to mention just, like, being secretive and sneaky and kind of, like, I'm not great at that. I'm just not. So I think that's why Bijal and I do not, he's not the character I gravitated toward.
Yeah.
But he's still very funny, and I loved a lot of the scenes with him and Casa and how close they are.
Yeah, and I think all four of them, you know, have their separate relationships with each other, and also there's this group dynamic, and the fact that they, you know, they can fight a little bit and still be best friends at the end of the day, I really loved all of that. I'm kind of with you, though, like, I mean, you know this about me by now, I cannot hide the emotions on my face. You can read me like a book. If I'm upset, you're gonna know it, even if I don't want you to know it, so yeah, I kind of understand that.
Yeah.
The last character with Winston, you know, in this little group, I also want to mention one of his friends kind of by the end of the book is Danny. He has a crush on Danny, who dresses in themes. I loved that about her. Right? It was like one of my favorite things. Plays the cello and always has a cocktail umbrella tucked behind one ear.
And she's the new kid.
Yes.
Like she introduces herself at the beginning of the book. So she is the new kid on the block. And I think by the end, we kind of see this, but I think she's going to fit into this friend group pretty well. Even if she doesn't play soccer, even if she doesn't, you know, I think she finds her way into their hearts and will kind of go right along with them.
Yeah. Next up is Philippa, who is Winston's older sister. She's always brooding. She doesn't really talk much. She's way more reserved than Winston. She always seems kind of angry. I loved her. She was, like, definitely a standout for me. Maybe because I'm not really a brooding kind of person, but I don't know. I liked her vibes. You could tell that it wasn't, like, obviously because their dad died kind of recently, a lot of it stems from that. And so you could kind of tell that it's, like, it's not that it's not real. It's just that, like, she's being honest with herself. She's being angry because she is angry, and she's brooding because she's sad and upset. But the best part about her is she still looks out for Winston, and you can see this, like, spark of a former closer relationship between them. And those moments where they decide to be, like, vulnerable with each other are really emotionally impactful.
Yeah, she's probably the character that I had the most trouble kind of figuring out. Because as Winston describes her at the beginning, you get this picture that she's just kind of, that she used to be more of, like, a typical teenage girl, like, liked makeup and going out and getting dressed up and always, you know, looked to the nines all the time. Like, it sounded like that's the character, that's who she used to be. And since her father died and things kind of got thrown, you know, into the air, she's become more of a grungy, does not, you know, has some, it gives a little bit of care to her appearance because he said she still loves to buy makeup and whatever. But, like, she doesn't really live that life anymore. She doesn't really care that much about the world or all that. She's, again, she's so angry about what's gone on, how it's affected her mom, her brother's lives, that she, that has become her, like, personality.
Yeah.
Like, the most definitive point of her personality right now is this anger, and it's kind of shaded everything else in it. And yeah, like, I love the way her and Winston kind of, at the beginning, she gives me impressions of being, like, the mean older sister, which I have an older sister, and I love her, but she was mean to me growing up.
Yeah.
She did not particularly love that I was 4 years younger and followed around all the time. We get along much better now, but, like, we were, you know, we had our things, and I got a bit of that in Philippa, where Winston's always just driving her nuts, and it's like, I'm an adult person. I don't need to be dealing with you all the time. Like, get out of my hair. And I loved that about the midway point of this book, we start to see just how much she really does care and look out for Winston that he doesn't notice.
Yeah.
Like, she's doing things off page, you know, to the side, and you're like, oh, like, Philippa really does care about Winston, is looking out for Winston, is trying to believe Winston, like, kind of the whole book. But because we're seeing her through Winston's eyes, at first it seems like she's just that sister.
Yeah.
And I kind of love that because Philippa's, you know, we said it's last week's episode title was The Deep Dark Onion Layer.
Yes.
It's like she's got a lot of layers to her, too. And that I liked kind of seeing them, unfurl one after another after another.
Yeah, I think that she's a very complex character because her relationship with Winston, like a lot of sibling relationships, isn't always great. They fight a lot. They annoy each other. They slam doors and lock each other out and don't want to tell each other the truth and don't believe them about things that are being said. But at the end of the day, they're still on the same team. And I think that, like, was shining through so well in this book, especially as you kind of get more into it. And I guess, you know, that kind of brings in this whole thing with Vic Fisher, who is the person that accidentally killed their dad in Iraq. And this whole thing was pretty heavy, and I want to talk about it more under the spoiler section.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, you know,
you get into more of the details. And
But I think that, like, B-plot, the story, really helped uncover her personality and how mature she is and how, like, immature Winston is. Not in a bad way.
No.
But he's 12 years old. Like, he doesn't understand everything that Philippa understands. And the fact that she can kind of be that older sister to guide him to a place of understanding and maturity was, like, really, like, nuanced and very well done.
She gives him the opportunity to be present for something that he does not understand he probably needs.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't know he needs it. She knows she needs it. Mm-hmm. And she knows that this will do more to help him be in a better place with his dad's death, then it will hurt, even if he can't recognize that that's what it is yet. And yeah, it is. It's very mature. It's very well handled. And honestly shocked me with how well it went and how honest these characters were with what was going on in their hearts, in their heads. Like, they had to really look closely at what was going on in that scene and with that whole B-plot. And yeah, really, really, honestly, very impressive to be able to put that into a, like, middle grade book.
Yeah.
And have it come across and be something you can learn about. Like, you know, I didn't lose a parent as a child, so I don't know that story. I don't know what that feels like. And I feel like now I have a better picture. Even, you know, I've read a lot of single parent books.
Yeah.
Sally Jackson.
Yeah.
Sally Jackson. Like, I mean, I've read a lot of books about single parents and the kid and all that. But, like, here, I feel like I got a better look at exactly what that means and, like, how to handle that sort of thing.
Yeah. The last bit with Philippa has to do with Monroe, Mav's older brother, who's definitely trying to win her over in various ways. And I ended up loving him way more than I thought I would. He was so smooth. Like, I thought he was going to be a little creepy in the beginning, but he ended up being, like, super smooth.
Yeah. He's another one that, but at the beginning of the book, I didn't really know what I thought about him because... Yeah. Like, Philippa had less than zero interest in, like, dealing with him, so I thought, okay, maybe he's a little odd or, you know, a little nerdy or something, and just not the kind of guy she would kind of want to even get to know. And then, as the book goes on, I was like, oh, like, is he going to be a little creepy? But no, like, yeah, by the end of the story, I was a big Monroe fan, especially with him and Mav, too, like... How he's always just kind of there and ready to help. That's not an older brother thing all the time.
Right.
Like, some families, I'm sure it works out that way. But, like, a lot of times older siblings are annoyed by the younger ones.
Yeah.
And I kind of love it. He's just, you know, if Mav needs him to give him a ride, he shows up. If Mav needs him to, you know, escort him to a movie or whatever, like, Monroe just kind of is there.
I was really surprised by actually both of them because there were, like, the number of times that Mav or Winston in particular asked them to drive them somewhere, sometimes random weird places.
Yeah.
And the number of times that they said yes, I was like, wow, like, this is really cool, you know? Like, you don't get that a lot.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I liked it. And then we get to Coco. Coco is the littlest child in the Chu family, and she is 3 years old. She definitely has a very strong personality.
Yeah.
And I loved how much Winston and Philippa loved her. There's none of that usual, like, rivalry over the baby, like, getting too much attention or anything like that.
The difference, like, age-wise between Winston and Coco, I think is probably pretty similar to the age difference between me and my youngest brother.
About
8 to 10 years.
Yeah.
For me, it's 10. I have another younger brother that's 8 years different from our youngest brother. And, like, it's different. I had siblings that were very close to my age growing up. And then my parents had another child, and he was so far removed, it was weird. Like, it was, you know, you had to get used to having a younger brother in the house.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things that, in this story especially, Winston and Philippa know, especially Winston, knows Coco so well.
Yeah.
Like, he knows her cry. He knows what toys she likes. He knows what her favorite show is and what, you know, that I kind of knew the same things about my littlest brother. I knew his favorite stuffed animal and his blankie, and I knew when he rubbed his eyes a certain way, he was tired. Because when you get to a certain point where you're a teenager or early, you know, preteen kind of age, you almost become a pseudo-parent sometimes for your younger siblings, especially if your mom needs your help because work or whatever, you're watching the kid all the time or whatever, you do kind of take on a bit of a pseudo-parent role. And that is a little bit of Winston and Philippa here.
Yeah.
They, because their mom is a single parent, you know, and needs their help raising Coco, she gets her stories read to her by her siblings, she gets put to bed by her siblings, you know, her mom is right there helping out. They're, you know, they, the three of them work together to parent Coco. And it's just very sweet to how it all works together and how well they know her and how well Winston can point out, that's not her. Look at this. This is different. And this is different. And this is different. And it's just,
Yeah. As an only child, I did not have that experience at all. And honestly, I was the youngest of my cousins, too. So, like, I was kind of the baby of the family. And so I, all of my experiences with sibling relationships are, I mean, some real life ones, obviously, because my cousins have siblings and, like, obviously I know your family and stuff like that, although now older, but a lot of it comes from movies and stuff like that. And so when there's a new baby, you know, all of the older siblings are like, oh, I don't want to babysit, or like, you know, even if there's only a couple years difference between them, it's like, oh, the baby's getting all of the attention. And I loved how much love there was, especially, we see it mostly with Winston because we're in his head, but the love that Winston has for Coco, the lengths to which he goes to protect her and save her and bring her back home. I mean, obviously, like, he's gonna do it. It's his sister, but, like, I really loved how, like, emotional and, like, soft and genuine all of that was.
There were a couple of times toward the end, but, like, throughout the book, where if I were Winston, I would have just thrown everything down and cried.
Yeah.
And he doesn't. Like, he keeps going, and he keeps trying, and he never gives up, and his friends help him out when he starts to get a little bit, you know, he starts to lose a little bit of hope. His friends are right there to, like, prove to him without having to tell him. They show him, like, here, we're here, we're still working on this, you know, we got this. And it just, yeah, I was like, I'm impressed that he doesn't just sit down and cry, because, like, he didn't ask for any of this.
Yeah.
And his, just wants to save his sister, and no one else realizes, you know, like, nobody else seems to get it. And it's, yeah, it's just so, it's very cute.
Yeah. And now, I mean, this isn't a spoiler because it happens right at the beginning of the book. And I think even in the synopsis, there's this whole thing about, like, his sister goes missing and stuff like that. Basically, she gets replaced by a changeling.
Yeah.
And the changeling was previously in, like, a doll's body. And so their souls got switched. So now this doll's soul is in Coco's body. And she doesn't act the way that Coco does, and doesn't always know, like, those little things that you were talking about that Winston notices, like, she doesn't know to act that way, even though she kind of does know some things about Coco and all of that.
Yeah.
And this, honestly, was way creepier than I thought it was gonna be. Like, I read a fair amount of, like, dark stories, horror stories and stuff. This was, like, this was a lot for a middle grade book that isn't meant to be, like, a thriller or a horror or anything.
Yeah. Anytime he was going home and I knew that there was going to be a not Coco scene.
Yeah.
I was like, oh boy, here we go.
Yeah.
Because this was so creepy.
Mm-hmm.
The way not Coco would just, like, do or say things in full sentences and be very creepy. And, like, nobody seemed to really notice it but Winston. And then, like, I'm just gonna say, the Book of Poison thing was just creepy in general. But, like, when it's a toddler or, you know, a three-year-old who's, that takes the cake.
Kids always make everything creepier. And this was, like, I'm glad, you know, I hope that Stacey Lee gets an adaptation if that's what her heart desires, but I don't know if I want to see Not Coco on screen. That's really going to freak me out.
Right?
Yeah.
It's, The Not Coco thing is very creepy. I could see an adaptation maybe softening it a little bit, making it funny scary, like, you know, but creeped me out.
Yeah, definitely.
For sure.
The last character I want to talk about is Mr. Pang. He's the one that owns the Shop of Whimsies. He's a pretty mysterious character that I've kind of, you know, I see him as a bit chaotic neutral. Like, he's not really a bad guy, but he's not helping either.
I think by the end of the book, you realize just how perfect a description chaotic neutral is for him. Because it's true. He's not necessarily a bad guy, but with everything that's going on, he's not helping either, which is making things harder, which is, like, Winston just wants to save his sister, and Mr. Pang is not being an ally in that search at all. Not necessarily doing anything to stop him, per se. Maybe a few things. Yeah. But, like, he's not really the bad guy. It's just, yeah, chaotic neutral is perfect.
Yeah. And, obviously, he's got his shop of whimsies. I think that, you know, I really loved the unicorns. They were maybe my favorite. But the dancing cactus was actually pretty cool, too. Did you have any favorites?
The unicorns were also quite... I'm quite fond of them.
Yes.
I also loved Danny's little cocktail umbrella, which is sort of related to that. We'll get to that in the spoiler section. But I think it qualifies as a whimsy. And I love the idea of a little cocktail umbrella that you tuck behind your ear, and the weather is going to be gorgeous.
Yes.
That's amazing. I want that. Like, I didn't know I needed that or wanted that in my life until this story. Now I know I want that in my life. And you can, like, if you want a rainy day, if you're just feeling like, bleh, you just take it out and the weather will be what it is. But if you really just need some sunny, wonderful, happy, warm day, you put it behind your ear and done.
Yeah. I really liked it too. Yeah. It was cool. Okay, let's get into our spoiler section, because I feel like I have so much more to say, and I'm really holding back. So, spoiler section.
Here we go. This is
your spoiler section.
Yeah.
Okay, so first up, Philippa, Winston, and Vic. This was really heartbreaking, but like we talked about before, so good to have in a middle grade story. Basically, we get Philippa and Winston going to meet Vic. He accidentally shot their father. It was, you know, a complete accident. He thought a guy was going for a weapon when really he was going for a photograph, and Vic kind of, you know, took his own weapon out and accidentally shot their father. He feels horrible about it. They were best friends. He had a lot of respect for him. And I really enjoyed how Winston came to understand how Vic could have accidentally done that to his father, because there's one point in the story where he accidentally hurts his friend too, and he was like, oh, like, I have a lot more sympathy for this man now. It doesn't make the pain go away, but it allows that wound to start healing.
Yeah, I was shocked that we actually broached this topic, like, the topic of, you know, meeting the man who killed your father and figuring out the feelings around that. And because there's so many stories where you meet the main character and the main character doesn't have a mother or a father because, you know, it's basically every Disney story.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Like, there's so many of those. So it didn't necessarily surprise me that he only had his mom in this story. But I think how much of a role his dad played in this book and how his dad's death affects a lot of the aspects of Winston's life was shocking. Like, just how often Winston would think back to something that they did together or would remember things. Like, yeah, I would think that's going to be present your entire life. Like, I still think about, you know, my grandparents and things we used to do. But it's an everyday thing for Winston. And seeing him meet Vic through Philippa, kind of with Philippa, and Philippa kind of seeing that this was honestly not going to be a negative thing for Winston. Like, you can see that she needs this for her anger. She needs to meet this guy. She needs to put a face to this person who took her father, but who also did not mean to take her father from her. Yeah, it's just such a mature story. Mm-hmm. And to fit it into this tale, this very chaotic, crazy, all-over-the-place story, it's handled so, so well.
Yeah.
And I loved, seeing Winston put pieces together and see that it is possible that this was an accident. Like, this guy really did not mean to take my dad from me, and hating him is not going to make my life any better. And maybe, you know, he learns that firsthand. And, like, that, it's just so well done.
I think not making Vic a bad guy was really important. And to be perfectly honest, this plot line did not need to exist in the story. There was enough else going on. We could have had the family kind of getting through this time after his dad dying together, and, you know, Philippa and Winston could have grown together and become friends again in a different way. This was a very affronting way of dealing with this plot point. And I love it so much because kids go through this stuff, and not putting it in a book like this isn't helping them. They need to understand what grief is, and they need to understand that sometimes confronting that grief, as difficult as it might be, could be the way to heal all of your trauma and, you know, all of that pain that you're still feeling. And I think that Winston is like a lot of other 12-year-old kids, because he has a lot of feelings and a lot of thoughts, and he's mature enough to understand what this whole situation is, but maybe doesn't really know how to handle it just yet. And this is a learning experience for him, and by proxy for us, if we mm-hmm. and for kids who are reading this book. So I really, really applaud Stacey Lee for writing this, because I don't think it was necessary to the book. She could have found another way to get Philippa and Winston on the same page, but this was so much better than, I think, kind of leaving that in the dark.
I agree. And yeah, just him being able to find some peace in the situation, even if, you know, when he first makes when Philippa and Winston go to meet Vic, Winston is not receptive to the situation at all. Like, he does not soften to Vic while they're there. Philippa kind of does. She, you know, has a conversation and she gets some of the answers she needs. But Winston is basically just like, I don't want anything to do with this guy.
Yeah.
And so he's present for the entire thing. But yeah, like, you can see just how much being there, seeing Philippa asking questions and getting answers she needs, you can see how he sees her doing that and how it affects him. Like, just seeing his sister be a good example of how to deal with your anger about things, like how sometimes you have to confront it, you have to meet the person who's responsible for the thing that makes you so mad, and seeing that they're a real person and not just this person, this, you know, this figure that you yeah. hate because they took your father. He's a real person who made a mistake, and, you know, that really just, it brings it all to, like, a, you know, we're all just people doing the best we can, and we feel sorry when we do things wrong, and, yeah, it's so nuanced and so very, very delicately handled. And
yeah.
It's a really, what's the word? It's like a boon to this book. It's not the word I'm looking for.
But it adds another layer.
Yeah, it's a very specific, you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful addition to this story that I'm so, so glad Stacey included.
Yeah, for sure. Philippa, you know, really matures by this point in the book, and she is really opening up a lot. And I think for the character who's, you know, very outwardly angry about all of this, the fact that she's the one that pushes to go speak to him and stuff kind of shows us how mature she is, and that she's really trying to work through this. And I really liked her relationship with Monroe, because she doesn't want to give him the time of day at first. And, like, he persists, but not in a creepy way. Like, in a very genuine way in which he's trying to help her, help Winston, you know, be there for his little brother and all that kind of stuff. And the fact that I think by the end of the book there's definitely potentially something going on with them makes me really excited to see where that's going to go.
For sure. Yeah, I kind of talked about Monroe before. He just came off a little weird at first.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if, like, he was going to be the kind of male character that keeps pushing the female character. And then he kind of does with the ukulele and the song. But by the end of that, where he hears her out, hears her reasoning for why she doesn't want to even try anything between them because their brothers are so close and she doesn't want to make that stressful for them. If, yeah. You know, like, it's very mature thinking. I know she's older, but, like, it's very mature thinking for someone, you know, of her age to kind of make that, to put all of that together and say, I don't want to even try to do anything with you because I don't want it to affect our brothers and their friendship. And then I think Monroe gets that. And then later on, she calls him because yeah. she has concerns about something both of her, you know, both of their brothers are involved in. And I think they just bond from there. And yeah. it kind of becomes a little something that maybe will continue to blossom. Maybe it won't. But mm-hmm. I am very excited to know that we've got another book or two coming in this series. I think we know there's one more, right?
We definitely know there's one more. Yeah.
Because I'm very interested to see how Philippa and Monroe factor into stories going forward. Mm-hmm. Because they're quite a pair, and I enjoy them together.
I think part of it too is Monroe, like, after, you know, when he plays her that song, she kind of turns him down, and I think Winston apologizes for her, and he was like, it was a privilege just to play for her. Like, he's not mad about it. He's not upset. Yeah. He's not, like, the wind isn't really out of his sails. And yes, he keeps pursuing her, but he definitely doesn't, like, overstep any boundaries. And I think that he's very, very aware of the reality of the situation and so isn't, you know, getting mad about it or anything. So that helps a lot.
Yeah. Agreed.
Moving on to Dani, she is brought into the secret and this world and everything that's going on. She's totally cool with everything. And it turns out that, like, her umbrella is another whimsy, and her aunt gave it to her to help keep her dry. And her aunt also has magic baking beans that help her win contests. And her aunt seems like maybe not the best person. Like, she's definitely more willing to, like, toe that line of, like, you know,
cheating.
Is this
not
the
cheating.
Right thing to do? Yeah, but yeah. I really liked Dani, and I really liked how she believed Winston pretty much right from the start. And that, you know, you're right. You were saying, like, she fits in with the group very easily. Like, she just slides right on in there. And it's just like, wow, this is, you know, it's like it was meant to be.
They tease Winston a little bit because they can kind of see his crush. Without him even having to say it, his teammates know.
Yeah.
And so I love how she is kind of in their orbit because Winston likes her. But then as the story goes on and she kind of becomes vital to the mission, they just bring her right on in. Yeah. Like, all right, let's go. You know, we need Dani. Let's go get Dani. Okay. And then, from then on, she's a valuable part of the group. And they're, you know, they're including her in decisions and, you know, trying to figure out what her skills are because they don't know her. So, like, they're figuring out what she knows and what she can do and how she can help. And, yeah, I really like
There's
Dani.
Just no jealousy. There's no, like, oh, you're bringing somebody else in. No, this is just us four, like, you know. And maybe that's something we get in the next book if they become closer.
Which is possible,
like,
yeah.
But I mean, that would be realistic. But I like in the beginning that it's just all so nice and pleasant.
Agreed. Definitely agreed.
So we actually didn't talk about them at all previously because I kind of wanted to save this for the spoiler section. But that broom and dustpan that Winston actually brings home holds the spirits of the cowherd and the cloud weaver, which is what this whole book is based on, the Chinese folktale of the cowherd and the cloud weaver. And basically, they're in love with each other, and the cloud weaver's mother does not like the cowherd and doesn't want her daughter running off with him. And so they're hiding in the broom and dustpan, I think, and the dustpan is a portal into Mr. Pang's shop. And they love each other so much, but, you know, like I said, the mother wants to zap them. Those storm scenes were, like, really intense.
Crazy, yeah.
But it was so interesting. Like, that was a mystery in and of itself. Like, oh, at first you think it's just pouring because it's pouring, and then you learn that there's more behind it, and then you see how the storm is acting like it has a consciousness, not like, you know, somebody is doing this on purpose, not that it's just a freak accident.
The lightning in the yard, in the patio thing. That whole thing is very scary.
Yeah, it was.
The actual, like, understanding the story behind the cowherd and the cloud weaver may be the part that was the most confusing for me to get through the audiobook. I think I just didn't quite grasp it. Like, I wasn't focused enough on that to really understand the interplay between all of those characters. As the story went on, it became clearer as I, you know, figured out the cowherd and the cloud weaver are in love and the mom and all of that. Like, it became clearer, but at first I think that was one of the things that I had struggled to kind of, like, figure out. I had never heard the story before. This is brand new mythology for me.
Same.
So hearing it and kind of figuring out that these were characters from the storybook that Winston was reading to Coco, and it's the story, that's all part of this book and the actual story going on, was a little crazy. But again, just, it's Winston chaotic. It's not, yeah. It's not chaos. It's just Winston chaotic. And I just had to figure out how to put all the pieces together that he was telling me.
Yeah.
But by the end, I definitely had a good idea of everything that was going on. And it's an interesting story. Like, it's very visual. Like, the idea is, of her beauty and him being kind of a little bit beastie.
Yeah.
He's a little bit dirty. Like, Winston always is talking about how he's, like, grody and whatever, because he's a cowherder. He's not, you know, he's not a prince or anything. Seeing their juxtaposition and, like, her mother's role in the whole thing, and mm-hmm. it was very cool, though.
And I kind of liked that story was a backdrop to Winston's story. Like, it wasn't like he was necessarily living out, like, you know, like Arusha, like, she kind of lives out some of the adventures. Even Percy, in a way, is very much, like, in the middle of mythology throughout all of those books. Whereas this is, like, this is kind of an added stressor on top of everything else that Winston's going through. And we learn that Winston's family has, like, a little bit of special chi inside them. They have a little bit more magic inside of them. So, like, he's definitely, like, special, but it's not like he's a reincarnation of whatever character, at least that we know of yet.
Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting. But I guess, oh, go ahead.
I was gonna say, this kind of relates to something I wanted to talk about quickly. I love that this story takes place in Winston's everyday life.
Yes.
So many of the books we've read with other mythologies, or like Percy or whatever, they end up getting removed from their everyday life and they get plopped into a quest or another world or whatever. This is the first one in a while where the protagonists are living in their home, going home every day, having to deal with living on a parent's schedule and going to school and taking care of their home chores and family and also trying to solve a problem at the same time.
Yeah.
I loved that so very much.
Yeah.
Like, I love a good adventure. I love a good fantasy where you leave the world you're in and go to a new one as much as the next guy. But I don't see as many of these stories as much anymore where you are in your life and you're also dealing with this new complication that happens to be supernatural or fantastical or crazy. And so, yeah, I really, really enjoyed that about this story. Watching him try to fit it all into his everyday was really cool.
I think the closest thing was almost Serwah, but even that, she got removed from her home life and, like, she still had to go to school and, like, live an everyday life on, like, other people's schedules.
But it's in a new place.
Yeah, it's not quite the same. So you're right, I hadn't thought about that before, but I also really liked that, like, he was trying to lead a normal life while also definitely not leading a normal life.
Not at all.
Yeah. This, I want to kind of move things around a little bit, because I think this is a good segue into talking about Mr. Pang, because he obviously had the broom and dustpan in his shop. He knew what was really going on with them. Turns out he's actually a bird who likes shiny things and has a tendency to pick them up off the street and everything.
I think it's Binjal who says, that's actually a cultural construct. And it made me laugh so hard when he said that. Like, it's just, it's just one of the lines in the book that made me laugh. Yeah. Like, that's actually a cultural construct. It's not that they like shiny things. It's that I forget the entire line. But it was so good. It made me giggle.
Yeah. So he basically wants to harvest moonlight because his brother, Mirth, wants to take over the world, essentially. And he is kind of trying to help the Cloudweaver and the Cowherd get away from their mother, and like it's the story's all kind of wrapped up together.
Yeah, the whole added bonus story of like learning the magpie thing with Mr. Pang being Sorrow and Mirth being another guy. Do we want to talk about that?
I mean, we will.
We're about to in a second. Yeah. But Mr. Goo being Mirth, that was like an added mythological bonus. Like, I knew nothing about any of that. So that kind of added to this Mr. Pang situation. It both added to my, like, kind of dislike for him. Because, like, I didn't hate him or anything, but I wasn't super fond of him because, like, all he's done is made everything more difficult and more complicated than
not intentionally, right, but still.
But, like, he still annoys me a lot.
Yeah.
But then, like, when you get to the end of the book and, like, everything that happens, you know, it's just very complicated. But I really did like the Sorrow and Mirth, like, that kind of weaved into the story itself. That was really, like, interesting and layered, and I'm sure will play a role in the future books.
Yeah. Yeah, I really liked that he was an antagonist without being a villain. Like, he was kind of another obstacle that they had to navigate, and even his, you know, his whimsy shop is neutral. Like, it's not like they're out to get him.
Right.
It's just that there's a lot of crazy things in there, and they have to figure out how to navigate that. And so I found all of that really interesting.
When it comes to the actual whimsies and, like, how Mr. Pang makes them and all of that, I really, really loved that Stacey Lee kind of decided that him making things out of people's most cherished possessions didn't mean that they were destroyed.
Yeah.
There are so many stories where a character has to give up the thing that means the most to them, and it's destroyed, and they can never see it again, and they have to live without it. It breaks my heart every time, because it's like, it's not the thing, it's what the thing reminds you of when you see it and touch it and talk to it every day or whatever. And so, like, in this story, seeing that the dog tags could have their chi drained from them, he gets them back and it recharges them to a point where they can be used again. And, like, he still, to this day, has his dad's dog tag, which is just a reminder every day of his dad.
Yeah.
I love that.
That was going to break my heart if he had to actually give them up. And he was willing to. Like, he wasn't sure what was going to happen.
Same with, like, his little sister's, like, stuffed blanket, the blankie thing. And I was like, no, you can't take a child's blankie, you evil jerk face.
Yeah.
But, like, it wasn't to destroy it. It was to use it and then return it, hopefully. Yeah. So, yeah. I liked that a lot.
Yeah, the whole Mr. Pang storyline is clearly not over yet. And, you know, they thwarted him for now, but Mr. Gu is going to be back. He's definitely trying to take over the world. I knew this guy was going to be trouble from the beginning. I was like, there's just something about him where, like, he's not a part of this story, but he keeps coming back. And I was like, he's going to be something. And then I was like, yeah, I know what's going on here.
I had two possible paths for Mr. Gu. Either he was going to be who he is and be an antagonist and be a problem, or he was gonna be the centaur guy from Onward who, like, shows up and romances their mother and, like, becomes their friend and is just kind of awkward and whatever. I couldn't decide which Mr. Gu was. Was he just a guy that his mom kind of liked who was gonna step in and be a father figure maybe in future books or whatever, or is he, like, vital to the story? And it turns out he is definitely vital to the story.
Yeah, and, you know, thank goodness Coco also gets switched back. But, like, is she going to be traumatized? Is she going to grow up remembering that she was a doll for several days?
Yeah.
This is a lot for a 3-year-old to handle.
Hopefully, it's early enough in her life that it will not affect.
She won't have nightmares.
Right. Hopefully. Because I cannot imagine what it was like being trapped in a doll and not really having all that much agency. A little bit, maybe, but not a lot. And, yeah.
Yeah. So Coco gets rescued.
And what kind of residue is left when a creepy demon thing is in your body? I don't know. That's creepy.
Ooh, that sent chills down my spine. I don't want to know.
Yeah. It's unclear.
But maybe we'll find out, because we do know now that there will be a sequel. Steph Lurie said on Twitter it'll be out in 2024. I mean, I think it's very clear that the story wasn't over anyway.
Yes.
They did not wrap it up in a nice little bow.
Nope.
But we also got the title recently, which is Winston Chu versus the Wingmeisters. We talked about that. And that's kind of what I was alluding to, is, like, are the Wingmeisters the two birds?
I mean, it's a good question.
Yeah.
Yeah. They very well could be.
Yeah.
I was trying to, by the end of the book, I was like, Wingmeisters? Like, who are these Wingmeisters? Because, yeah, Mr. Gu basically has those two goons who do his work. I think they call him Bert and Ernie throughout the book.
Yeah, they do. And they turn into seagulls.
Yeah. So, like, he has these two goons who are kind of, like, doing his bidding throughout the book, and we don't know it yet. But, yeah, I was curious if it was going to end up being them, or, like, with his political career, is he going to have to enchant something to, like, defend himself, you know, or something like that. So, yeah, I'm very interested to see what a Wingmeister is. Is it these two guys?
Yeah. Or is it something else? I can't imagine that's the nickname the kids, like, give them or something like that, but I guess we'll have to see. But then again, if they go up against them first, against mirth and sorrow first, like, does that mean there will be a third book? Or, like, obviously we don't know yet. I have a lot of, like, curiosity for what other stories Winston might come up against, because neither one of us are very familiar with Chinese mythology or folktales, so... Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even have guesses at this point. New whimsies and stuff like that. I'm very excited to see what that could be like.
The possibilities there are endless. Yeah. So, like, that's really cool.
Yeah.
I think two of the things that kind of stuck out to me by the end of the book that I was unsure of is Mr. Gu is not aware that Winston and his friends are onto him, right?
Correct.
So, like... They kind of have one up on Mr. Gu at this point. They can kind of keep an eye on him and see what's going on, and then eventually maybe kind of expose...
I'm sorry. We're almost done.
And so then eventually maybe they'll expose their knowledge of who he is and what he's up to and all of that. But I kind of like that they've got a one up on Mr. Gu at this point. And the other thing was the end of this story. There's a thing with a canoe and the water...
Oh, how did we not talk about this?
About...
I forgot.
Okay.
About the goldfish.
Oh, yes, the goldfish. Oh my god, we forgot about that. We'll get to the goldfish in a minute.
That was so awesome.
We'll get to the goldfish in a minute, because yes, I do want to talk about Lucky. No, but like, did Mr. Peng die? At the end of the story, he kind of sinks into the water... Yeah. And we don't hear from him again.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. Like, I don't feel like it's that easy to kill Mr. Peng. I just don't. But it was so left wide open that I kind of wondered if he died and that something, like, what was going to happen to his shop? Like, if he dies, does the shop disappear? Does everything that goes with it disappear since it's kind of magical? Or are they going to have to get back into the shop or whatever? So I'm very intrigued as to how Mr. Peng weighs into future stories. Is he gone? Does he have a role to play? Like, will he become an ally? Is there a possibility he could become an ally against his brother if they really all work together and they're not trying to save Coco?
Yeah.
You know, like, they may be able to work with Mr. Peng as opposed to working against him, kind of. So, yeah, those were the two things that just Mr. Gu's relationship with them and how they know him, and then the thing with Mr. Peng. But yes.
But Lucky.
We gotta talk about Lucky.
It was so exciting.
Oh my God.
I was not expecting it to be a giant goldfish living in the ocean.
I was as wounded as Winston when Lucky disappeared, because I was like, oh my God, he can't survive. He's a fish. He needs water. Like, is he taking care of him? Did he put him in the water as soon as they swept him into the shop? Like, what happened to Lucky? And I was as distraught as Winston. Mm-hmm. And then I forgot a little bit about Lucky, kind of like Winston did.
Yeah.
Just kind of, you know, it's there, but you forget about it. And
then voice calling out, I was having bad feelings about it.
In the audiobook, it literally is a Winston, which reminds me of Ghostbusters and the creepy voice calling Winston's name in the subway. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is scary. But then I realized, like, it's not a scary, like, they're not trying to be scary. It's just... A goldfish is a very simple creature.
Yes.
And so all it knows is how to say Winston's name.
Yes.
Winston.
Over and over again. It was so funny. It's one of those little audiobook bonuses where you get somebody doing a voice for Lucky, and it's so the opposite of what I would have picked if I was doing the voice in my head. But it worked out really well. So, yeah. No,
that's awesome.
I loved that. Lucky. I'm so glad Lucky's okay.
Yeah, me too. That was a delightful...
end to that little tidbit of story.
Yeah. I definitely didn't expect it, and so it made it so much better.
So much same.
Yeah. If you guys enjoyed listening to us talking about Winston, if you enjoyed Winston Chu at all, please let us know. Write into us. We would like to talk about it. If you have any theories for the next book, if you're familiar with Chinese mythology,
absolutely,
and you have ideas what kind of story Stacey could pull from, please let us know, because I have no clue, and I would like... at least a little bit of a hint.
Yeah, like, this is definitely very, very new territory for us. I know very, very little about Chinese mythology, so this is all fun and surprising. And yeah, the next book will be a different adventure, a whole new adventure.
Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. You can follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts as well. If you like revisiting your favorite canceled and cult classic shows, consider tuning in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions about Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and many more. We also have Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. Lastly, we also have Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which has discussed every episode of the show, contains exclusive interviews, and will be covering the upcoming Teen Wolf movie, as well as Jeff Davis's new show, Wolfpack. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter, at Prophecy Podcast, or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr, at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us, our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and that would be a massive help. You can leave us questions or comments or ideas for episodes and content you want to hear from us in any of these places. We do have a little bit of feedback this week. I'm going to throw it to Karen because she ran a poll.
I did. Actually, first, I want to say thank you to everyone who joined our giveaway for yes. Jay Maya's album. We gave them out, so congratulations to, can I remember who they are? So, Four Eyes for Life won one of them, Rachel won one of them, and Laura won one of them.
I knew one of them.
Yeah, Laura, we've known Laura for a very long time. Yeah. She has been a longtime fan of some of our other podcasts, so that was really awesome. Thank you, everybody, for entering, for spreading the word, and please continue to go listen to Jay Maya, because she's going to be huge, and you're going to have to hear her someday anyway.
She'll be
all over the radio.
I was going to say, and I'm pretty sure she's probably going to be back on the podcast. Because we had a really good time talking to her, so...
But I did run a poll, yes, because we had finished the short stories for the main series, all the ones that were, like, very closely tied to the first 5 books, and I was like, I want to know what everybody's favorite short story is, and I kind of wanted to look at them myself, because I was like, oh, you know, I really enjoyed Staff of Hermes. Do I like that more than Sword of Hades? I don't know, but, like, what are some of the other ones? How do I feel about them? Do you have a favorite? Does one really stick out in your mind?
I mean, Staff of Hermes is kind of sticking out the tallest for me at this point. The others have been fun or have added a little something, but I feel like that one just, it gives us so much. Mm-hmm. Not just by way of, like, the shield that answers a question about the shield, but it gave us a lot when it comes to, like, Percy and Annabeth and kind of seeing them make the transition from friends who fight together to romantic whatever that kind of comes into play for Heroes of Olympus. So I think it might be Staff of Hermes for me.
Okay, cool. I mean, I definitely support that decision. I was really surprised. So we ran the poll, and I had to split it up in two because you can't have 6 options on a poll, which seems ridiculous to me. And so the first half was Story of Luke Castellan, Stolen Chariot, and Bronze Dragon. Story of Luke Castellan won by 63.8%. It wasn't really even close. Bronze Dragon came in second, and Stolen Chariot came in third. And we got about 50 votes on that one. The next one only had about 30 votes, so I think maybe, you know, people really did only vote for one, although you could obviously vote for two. So I don't know if we should run another poll, because Sword of Hades won this one by 77.8%, and Singer of Apollo and Staff of Hermes were both at 11.1%, which surprised me, because Singer of Apollo wasn't my favorite one. It's probably down at the bottom of the list for me. But Staff of Hermes, like, I really expected that one to have more.
Yeah, it's Sword of Hades is a good one, but something about Staff of Hermes just sticks out for me. I don't know.
Yeah, so it was cool getting those results, though. Thank you if you voted in that, and I don't know, maybe we'll see if I run another one to see if people like the Story of Luke Castellan or Sword of Hades more. I do kind of like causing a little bit of chaos myself, so we'll mischief? Just have to see.
There's mischief to be made?
Yes.
Mischief mustache?
So, also, shout out to Seaweed Brain Podcast, who said they can't wait to listen to our Persebeth episode because they have a brand and they're sticking to it.
I saw this. And it made me smile.
I love that so much. They're great and they're amazing on Twitter. If you don't follow them, you really should, because they're
Delightful.
They're funnier than I am. I'm just going to say it out loud. I'm just going to admit it. But that's okay. It's because all right. I try.
Okay, so that pretty much wraps up our episode this week. Next week, we're doing a Percy Jackson and the Olympians wrap-up. We want to take a look at the series as a whole and just kind of take stock of things we learned, things we know, things that might be important, I don't know, all that stuff. So if you have any specific Percy Jackson and the Olympians thoughts,
yeah,
make sure to send them to us. Let us know what you're thinking because, yeah, we wanted to do one big episode where we talk about the series as a whole and kind of what it does and all of that before we move on completely to the Egyptian books and kind of focus on that.
Yeah, so if you've got a favorite book, if you've got favorite moments, favorite quotes, anything like that, write into us, let us know. I really want to gather a bunch of feedback for this one because this is the last time, for a while at least, that we're really going to focus on not only, you know, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, that first series, but also Greek mythology and Percy Jackson in general because we will be switching over to the Kane Chronicles. So I want all of your feelings.
Yes.
And I want to read them out onto the podcast. Please and thank you.
Yeah. So until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.